Welcome to What Are You Reading, a podcast dedicated to leadership development through commitment to reading.
This is your host, Ryder Ashcraft. Today, I am joined by Ambassador Nicholas Burns. Ambassador Burns is the Roy and Barbara Goodman Family Professor of the Practice of Diplomacy and International Relations at the Harvard Kennedy School. As a career Foreign Service officer, he was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs from 2005 to 2008. State Department's third-ranking official when he led negotiations on the U.S.-India Civil Nuclear Agreement, a long-term military assistance agreement with Israel, and was the lead U.S. negotiator on Iran's nuclear program. Previous assignments include the ambassador to NATO, Greece, and the State Department spokesman. He has a bachelor's in history from Boston College and a master's in international relations from the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Ambassador, thank you for joining us today.
Lieutenant, it's a great, great pleasure to be with you, and thanks for the opportunity.
First question, what are you currently reading?
So you're going to get my pandemic reading list. My wife and I have been in Westport, Massachusetts for the last 13 months. I've been teaching on Zoom, and we've read a lot, both of us. So I read a great book, Rick Atkinson, The British Are Coming. Rick Atkinson's a military historian. Wrote a phenomenal three-part series of the American Army in Europe during World War II, and now he's chronicling the American military campaign, the Revolutionary War. And my wife and I also live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, right down the road from the Longfellow House, which is where Washington had his headquarters when he formed the Continental Army in 1775, 1776. So The British Are Coming is the first volume of a three-volume history of the Revolutionary War. I read that. Read a memorable book called Say Nothing by Patrick Radden Keefe. It's about the troubles in Northern Ireland. It's nonfiction. It is a searing portrait of what happens to communities in a violent setting, which is what Northern Ireland had been before the Good Friday Agreement. And did a lot of reading about modern figures. I read President Obama's first volume, A Promised Land. He's an extraordinary writer. You know, he wrote the book himself. I read Fred Logervall's poem of John F. Kennedy called JFK. Fred is a colleague of mine at Harvard Kennedy School. He's a great historian. This is going to be, I think, the finest life on President Kennedy as he gets to the second volume as well. I'm just about to start reading The Man Who Ran Washington, which is about James A. Baker III, who was one of our great secretaries of state for George H.W. Bush, very accomplished. And he was not only secretary of state, he was secretary of the treasury and chief of staff to President Reagan. And this is a book by Peter Baker and Susan Glasser, two of the most powerful journalists in Washington. They also happened to be married, so they worked on the book together. And so I read all those, but I also, I thought, well, it's pandemic. My wife and I were socially isolating. We really didn't see a lot of people, a lot of time to read. She likes to read as well. So I said, what's missing? What have I not read in terms of great literature? So I read Moby Dick this past summer. And just, I mean, and you would identify with this about the sea and about courage on the sea. And the Moby Dick is just a great book. And I read Middlemarch because all sorts of people have told me that Middlemarch is one of the great, great novels in the English language. I'd missed it in high school and college. So I've been reading a lot and it's been really fun to do that.
Sir, that's quite a book list from the pandemic. I've also heard that you have been a lifelong avid reader, especially during your career during the State Department. Are there any books that stood out in the way they influenced you during a particular time in your career?
Oh, there's so many. I was a history major in college and love history and love biography. I became interested, I grew up in the 60s and 70s outside of Boston. And this was during the Vietnam War. It was during the three horrible assassinations of President Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy. And that's what really got me interested as a young person in the world and in public service and in American politics. It was the lives of those three people. I came from an Irish Catholic family outside of Boston. So there was no question that President Kennedy was a big figure in our community. as was Robert Kennedy, maybe the person I admired the most, and I admired both of them, but the person who really gripped me was Martin Luther King. I was very young when he died, 12, but after his death, I began to read about him. And there are all sorts of documentaries. And I had several teachers who really impressed upon us how great a figure he was. So those three people made a big impact on me as an adolescent, thinking about what I might want to do in the world. And I read as much as I could about them. Books that stand out that might still be relevant for your generation of military officers and public servants would be any books on those three people, but also on Churchill. I'm a great admirer of Churchill and his heroism, his heroic leadership during the Second World War. And with Churchill, Andrew Roberts has written a newish biography of Churchill, which a lot of people are saying is probably the best thing ever written about him. It's 800 or 900 pages. It's not for the faint of heart. William Manchester, who's an American Marine Corps veteran of the war in the Pacific and became a great post-war historian, kind of a social historian based at Wesleyan University in Wesleyan in Middletown, Connecticut. He wrote a two-volume biography of Churchill, which was memorable to me. George Kennan, probably the greatest American diplomat of the last 80 years. His two-volume memoir of his time in the Foreign Service is required reading for any Foreign Service officer in training. And I would advocate that for military officers because, of course, he was dealing with our new relationship with the Soviet Union in the 1930s as a young diplomat who spoke Russian. He was in Germany at the outbreak in our embassy in Berlin at the outbreak of World War II. He was interned by the Nazis for a time before he was exchanged for German diplomats in the United States. And he became, of course, author of the containment strategy, which was the most important post-war World War II concept that guided the strategy of the United States, both for the military as well as for the State Department. So Kennan's two-volume history memoir is brilliantly written. Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State who created NATO, who was pivotal in our post-war policy under President Truman, his book, Present at the Creation, another required book, I think certainly for diplomats, but I think for military officers as well. And then finally, I'd say, and these are all historical figures, but I learn a lot through biography and through reading history. And if you want to read about one of the great American presidents, I think the greatest since Lincoln, FDR, James McGregor Burns's two-volume biography of FDR is really brilliant because the first volume gives you, of course, great insight into the New Deal, which should be resonant for us now because of what President Biden is doing to remake the American economy and the American social safety net for poorer people in our country and for the middle class. The second volume, of course, details FDR as wartime leader as he prosecuted the two-front war in Europe and the Pacific against fascism. And so I learned a lot from biography and history, and that was important to me as a young diplomat trying to piece together my own view of how America should act in the world.
Sir, you've alluded to it with the book recommendations you've given so far, but can you elaborate on the relationship between the State Department and the military as we move forward in foreign policy, especially now that we've recently seen Secretary Austin and Secretary Blinken joining together on their first overseas trip to our Asian allies?
I think this link between the State Department and the Defense Department, between our diplomats and our generals and admirals, is pivotal to our understanding of how we can best defend our country and be successful around the world. Lots of people, I think, have recognized, political theorists, American presidents like John F. Kennedy, that defense and diplomacy, and I would say intelligence, go hand in hand. They're the three big pillars of American power in the world. And, you know, obviously the military, and I so much honor my military brethren, people with whom I served at US-NATO, which is a combined joint State Department, Defense Department mission. What you do in the military is fundamental to our society. Protecting America from our adversaries, from threats, from 9/11 terrorists, from the Soviet Union during the Cold War, from Putin and Xi Jinping now, there's nothing more important. And so your job in the military is of first order importance. I think our job is too, those of us who've served in the State Department and the Career Foreign Service, because we have to work hand in glove. We have to be completely in sync, strategically and tactically, we in both of our institutions, to be successful for the American people. We've just come through, I think, a really unique period in American history since 9/11, the last two decades, when we were hit hard on 9/11. We came out swinging. I supported that war. Obviously, I was ambassador to NATO at the time. We went into Iraq in March 2003. I think most people, and myself included, I supported that war in 2003, but I regret it now, and think it was the incorrect decision. But we've had two decades where we've primarily relied on the military and our intelligence community to defend ourselves and to be influential in the world. And I think we're arriving at a time, we have arrived at a time actually, where we're gonna have to lean more on our diplomats. That doesn't mean we won't lean on submariners like yourself, lean on anyone else in the military. It just means that we have to have a foreign policy that is more balanced. The military remains and will remain critical to us, but it needs a stronger State Department as a partner. If you think of a couple of examples of major challenges we face, climate change, we're gonna have to organize a global coalition to reduce carbon emissions and to work together. That's gonna be primarily a diplomatic function. Pandemics and global health problems are with us now, big time, and will be with us in the future for sure. And that's gonna be a diplomatic challenge to organize the world to be much more effective in responding to the next pandemic as we have responded to this pandemic. Think of the fact that the power balance in the world between the United States and Russia, the United States and China, is more narrow now. I just interviewed and welcomed President Clinton to the Kennedy School a couple of days ago. And we were talking in my interview with him about the fact that during his presidency, we were at the apex of our military and political and economic power in the world in the 1990s. Thank goodness we're still the strongest military power in the world, but the gap between us and China is narrowing, and the gap between us and Russia is narrowing. And so that means we'll have to rely on our diplomacy as well as our military to get our way, to be successful, to achieve our national interests. So a bigger role for state and diplomacy to coincide with the role of the military, I think that's the big imperative for your generation. And that means that I think we ought to be training our officers across our departments at the junior officer, mid-level, and senior officer level. What do I mean by that? You are a young naval officer. You ought to be training with young State Department officers, and they ought to be training with you, so that both officer corps, you know, rise up together in leadership, and you know each other. You're comfortable with what each other does for the United States. You understand the mission of the State Department, and the State Department understands yours. We don't do that well enough in Washington, and we ought to do more of it. And I think that's the proper way to think about American power.
Ambassador, that's a fantastic idea. At a minimum, the understanding between junior officers in the military and State Department officers about which role each department plays in U.S. foreign policy and international affairs moving forward. Is there anything you would recommend besides maybe the books and biographies you've already recommended to help these officers prepare to understand each other's roles better if they don't have those training opportunities in the future, but they know that this interoperability is going to be happening in the very near future?
Yeah, you know, thank you, Lieutenant. And just to extend the thought based on your question, you know, I think where the military has done brilliantly is in the concept of jointness in Goldwater Nichols. And bringing the military services together strategically and operationally. I think our State Department officers should seek assignments where they're co-located with the military. And we have such assignments in all the combatant commands. You know, all the combatant commanders around the world, in Honolulu, in Tampa, in Stuttgart, have American State Department advisors. I think it's very good for military officers, particularly those at the, Navy captain, admiral level, and those at the major colonel general level and the other services are seeking assignments co-located with American embassies. And when I was ambassador to Greece, I had many military officers on my staff. Of course, the defense attachés, the naval and army and air force attachés at NATO, I think we had more military officers and DOD civilians than we did State Department diplomats at my mission there. And we learned from each other. We actually worked together day by day. And that takes it well beyond even training, actually, to be working together. And it's important for State Department officers to have a much keener sense of our military strategy, important for our military officers to understand, the diplomatic aspects of our rivalry with China. Rivalry is not even the best word for it. Our competition and adversarial relationship with China and our adversarial relationship with Russia are two big competitors in the world today.
Well, bringing up China and Russia leads me to my next question. How should the State Department and the U.S. military be preparing to operate together to face the challenges of the great power competition?
I think in addition to climate change, this is the greatest threat to the United States over the next 20 to 30 years. So that's your career and the career of all the military people listening to this podcast. We have to have a multifaceted strategy to compete with China. We're competing, obviously, for strategic military power in the Indian Ocean, the Western Pacific. China's challenging us militarily. China, through its Blue Water Navy, through its ballistic missiles, through its acquisition illegally of a lot of territory in the Spratlys and Paracels, in the South China Sea, in the Senkakus, trying in the East China Sea. So therefore, we got to hold our ground militarily. They're competing with us economically, and they're not playing by the rules of the World Trade Organization. They're violating their international trade commitments to the disadvantage of American companies and American workers. They're competing with us technologically. They want to be ascendant in AI, machine learning, quantum sciences, biotechnology, and they want to militarize those technologies and leapfrog us in terms of military capacity. And they also are competing with us ideologically. If you listen to Xi Jinping, the Chinese mantra for the last year or so has been the East is rising, that's China, and the West is diminishing. And that's us, in their estimation. I don't believe that. I don't think you believe that. But we've got to compete with the Chinese across all four of those battlefronts, as it were. And that is going to entail a combined strategy of the Treasury Department, the Commerce Department, the State Department, the Defense Department, the intelligence community, to compete and to hold our ground. And it entails deepening the Quad. President Biden was the first American president ever to have a Quad summit with Japan, Australia, India, the United States. He did that just in his second month of the presidency, second or third month of his presidency. So that is jointness across the US government. That's a joint strategy that we've all got to be involved in. And that's further ammunition for this thought that you and I are talking about, that the military and the State Department need to be working much more closely together, training together, thinking together about how we combine our strengths to limit what China is trying to do, to contain what the Russians are trying to do in Eastern Europe.
Sir, so you talked about China and this giant competition that they have with the United States economically, technologically, ideologically, and that will require a lot of resources from the military, from the State Department, from the Treasury in the coming years, just given the scale of China's ascendancy. How do we balance that with our commitment to NATO and the Russian campaigns against Eastern European states, misinformation campaigns against large Western powers? How do we have enough resources to fight, maybe not fight, but at least compete on both of these fronts in different parts of the world?
It's going to be a challenge, but it's a challenge we have to meet because we're a global power. And the United States, of course, is focusing a lot nowadays on the Indo-Pacific, as we should. We have neglected it for too long. And therefore, we're going to have to make a major military and diplomatic commitment to be stronger in the Indo-Pacific. But at the same time, Europe remains vital to the United States. Europe's our largest trade partner. Europe is the largest investor in the American economy. The greatest number of American treaty allies in the world are the NATO countries, Canada and 28 European countries. And so we're going to have to be resourceful and strong enough in terms of our budgetary allocations to make sure that we are a strategic, we are the strongest strategic player in the Indo-Pacific as well as in Europe and the North Atlantic. Those are the two critical regions for us. And of course, because we're a global power, we live in the Western Hemisphere, we're going to have enough additional strength to do what we have to do here in North America, working with Canada and Mexico. In Central and South America, we have a strategy that needs to be fulfilled there. I think we are, I think we'd be right to disengage, hopefully in an effective way that doesn't reward the Taliban in Afghanistan. A friend of mine likes to say that we took a massive strategic detour into the Middle East over the last two decades. We certainly did after 9/11 in the Iraq War, in our deployments to Syria, in the fight in Libya in 2011, NATO's campaign. I think we're going to have to make some choices and really consider that the two main strategic priorities have to be the Indo-Pacific and Europe. And we certainly have enough strength in the United States government, in the military, and the State Department to be effective in both places. It's going to take major budgetary allocations too. We've been spending on the military and the Defense Department, you know, a little over $700 billion a year for a long time now. I support that. I don't think we can afford major reductions in our military budget. We've not been spending enough in the State Department, which is a much smaller institution, of course, than the military. We have about 13,000 Foreign Service officers, and that pales in comparison to what the military has. So it's not going to be as expensive, but the State Department has not been funded adequately. We need to do much more to lift up our Foreign Service officers. And two colleagues, if people are interested, two colleagues of mine, Ambassador Mark Grossman and Ambassador Marcy Reese, and I published a Harvard Kennedy School report in November calling for a fundamental overhaul and strengthening of the American Foreign Service. You know, for all the reasons that you and I have been talking about as we go through all these issues.
Is there an opportunity for the military and the State Department to combine at a very low level, possibly at an undergraduate level or a graduate school level, in programs that provide both a strategic point of view for the military and diplomatic point of view for the State Department, so that these future colleagues can start working together at the beginning of their career versus at maybe an embassy overseas or at higher levels of government?
I think it's a really good question, Lieutenant. And I think, you know, we can certainly do that in Washington at the National War College, at the Foreign Service Institute. They're both in Virginia. We ought to be having joint courses, as we've talked about, for our military and our State Department officers. But your suggestion is a very good one. We can also do that at schools like your school, Georgetown, or the school where I teach now, Harvard Kennedy School. Let me just give you a data point that will indicate how difficult this has been for state. At Harvard this year, this academic year, 2020-2021, we have 53 military officers, and we're very happy to have them in training with us in 1 and 2 year programs. And we have 2 State Department officers. And so one of the things I'm interested in doing is trying to build a much bigger program here to take in more State Department officers so that at least at our university, the young military and the young State Department officers can be studying together and working together and getting to know each other, as you say, so that they have a sense of what each other does for the country from the very beginning of their careers.
Is there an opportunity there for regionally focused studies, or do you think that these future officers in both the State Department and the military would benefit more from a globally focused academic program?
I actually think both. You know, students at both of our universities obviously self-direct. And so some of our students come to us and they want to study China, or they want to study Latin America or Africa. Others are more, they want to build their sense of sophistication about global politics and overall strategy. So I think you can actually do both at a research university like Harvard or Georgetown or Stanford or UT Austin or University of North Carolina. There's tons of institutions in our society that can do this. And this is going to be such a difficult, challenging time for America because we've been dominant for so long, really since the close of the Second World War. We're still the strongest power in absolute terms, but in relative terms, many others are gaining on us. So we're going to have to recalibrate a little bit to strengthen the diplomatic side of our government so that we can be effective across the board. And that starts in our war colleges, it starts in the Foreign Service Institute, but it has to start in our universities as well. When I arrived at Harvard in the autumn of 2008, I'd been in the Foreign Service my whole career, and I was really amazed that Harvard had so many programs focused on the military, on military history, on nuclear weapons, and I was all in favor of that, and nothing pertaining to diplomacy. So I started a program called the Future of Diplomacy Project, which is meant to deepen our understanding of the utility of diplomacy. And so I think that all of our institutions have to be trending in that fashion.
So I'm going to change gears just a little bit, but still relating to the diplomacy aspect. You used to be the ambassador to NATO during the Bush administration. You worked closely with our allies amidst a deployment of a coalition force to Afghanistan when Article 5 was invoked for the first and only time. Since then, how have you seen not only the NATO alliance change, but our other alliances, maybe the Pacific Alliance, change? And how do you anticipate those partnerships being relevant and important as the Biden administration continues to affirm their commitment to diplomacy around the world?
Yeah, that was my assignment as ambassador to NATO 2001 to 2005 was one of the most meaningful experiences that I had in government, because I really grew to understand how important it is that America not think of itself as being alone in the world. I say that because, you know, we've been talking about history and books to read. One of the great fault lines of the American people going all the way back to our founding has been, are we engaged in the world? Should we be part of the world? Should we lead the world, or should we be isolated from the world? We saw that the founding fathers and the early presidents debated, you know, how much we should be involved in the world. President Theodore Roosevelt very much believed we should lead in the world, but there was a whole group of people who resisted the Spanish-American War of 1898, and our acquisition of colonies. Major debates in the United States over whether or not we should defend Britain and France in 1939-40, the isolationist movement led by people like Charles Lindbergh, the students at Yale forming an isolationist group. And now it's reappearing. I think certainly on the far right of our political spectrum, there's a very strong isolationist group, and certainly in the far left, there's isolationism as well. And, you know, you won't be surprised to hear me say, someone who served in the U.S. government, that I think isolationism will weaken America. And so the great insight that President Biden has is bring back our alliances, return the United States to leadership of the NATO alliance. You've seen the major focus he's had on our three big treaty allies in East Asia, Japan, South Korea, and Australia, our defense agreements with the Philippines and Thailand, our newfound security partnership with India. It's critical that the United States thinks of itself as alliance-minded, because these alliances, they strengthen us, they magnify American power. If you do any kind of data comparison of the military power between the United States and Russia, you line up the figures, and the United States is stronger than Russia. If you add NATO, we're exponentially stronger than Russia. And do the same exercise with China. The United States, I think, is still stronger than China militarily. Maybe not by a lot, but we are. But if you add Japan and Australia and India, the Quad countries, well, we're much stronger than China. And so I think President Biden, maybe one of the most important things that he's doing in the early months of his presidency is returning us to those alliances. And I am a proud veteran of the U.S. mission to NATO. I saw how well we worked together there. You know, it's a really unique mission. Every American embassy in the world is headed by an ambassador who reports through the Secretary of State to the president. That's the reporting chain, except for the United States ambassador to NATO. He or she reports through the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense to the president. We're the only combined U.S. State Department, U.S. Defense Department mission in the world. And I learned so much there from my military colleagues. And that kind of fusion is going to be critical to our future. So alliances, I'm all for, and coalitions that maybe fall short of being a treaty alliance, but a coalition on climate change, for instance, a coalition on cyber, a coalition on trade against China. We've got to be practicing that kind of diplomacy too.
Sir, you have me sold on the relationship between the military and the State Department and what the future of alliances are moving forward. All right, last question for you. Do you have any other words of wisdom or encouragement for the DoD Reads audience?
My words of encouragement starts with words of admiration. You know, I never served in the military. I'm a State Department person, but I've seen enough of what you do to really admire what the American military is. Secretary Powell, I worked for Secretary Powell when he was Secretary of State. And I remember him telling us that he felt that the volunteer military was a better, stronger military than the conscript military that he grew up in during the Vietnam War. And I think you are. I've worked enough with the military to see what an escalator up institution you are for poorer Americans. Americans maybe who come from diverse communities, racially, ethnically, who aren't maybe sometimes, who are definitely not given the chances that they need to succeed in our society, but they can succeed in the military. I've seen what you can do, what you do for the American people during war, Afghanistan, and during peace. I'll never forget going with General Martin, who was then commander of U.S. Air Forces Europe, and I was ambassador to NATO. He took me to Landstuhl Hospital. I think it was 2004, if I'm not mistaken. And he said, we're going to visit the wounded. And he and I went through the wards and visited young men and young women who had been wounded, some quite severely, in combat in both Iraq and Afghanistan. It was the most humbling experience I probably ever had to meet these young men and women who, you know, who had lost a lot, who had sacrificed a lot, and still, you know, maintain their spirit and their, of course, their patriotism. And I just couldn't have been more impressed. I have a nephew. My nephew Ben Hutchins is a colonel in the U.S. Marine Corps. He heads the Marine Air Group in Yuma, Arizona. He's both a Harrier pilot, now an F-35 pilot, and he's had, I think, over 200 combat missions and 5 wartime deployments as a pilot. And so I don't want to single him out above anybody else, except to say that, you know, from my firsthand knowledge of Ben's service, which we're so proud of in our family, I just think the military is, you know, we couldn't survive in the world today without the military. So I thank all of you who are in the military. I thank you for choosing public service, whether you stay in for a full-fledged career, whether you choose to leave, you know, you've done your bit for the United States, and you should be very proud of that because we're all proud of you.
Thank you so much for joining us today, sir. It's been a real pleasure.
Lieutenant, thanks so much, and all best for your career and everything that, thank you for what you've done for the United States.
Sea Air Space 2021 is returning in person at Gaylord National Harbor Conference Center August 2nd through 4th. Don't miss this opportunity to get face-to-face, listen, and learn from top sea service leaders from U.S. Naval leadership from around the globe. Join us for our new hiring event, Transition Connection, connecting you to real employers seeking veteran talent with interviews on site. Real connection, real opportunity. Hosted by Navy League of the United States, register today at seaairspace.org.
Thanks for listening to this episode of What Are You Reading? a podcast produced through partnership with DoD Reads. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, subscribe, and share it. Leave us a comment with your answer to the question, what are you reading? Also, visit dodreads.com for free books, book reviews, interviews with your favorite authors, and many more free professional development resources. See you next week.